Now I face out, I hold out, I return to the truth of my life, seeking the seas on the whole moment to now break away. Oh God, let me out, can you let me out, can you set me free from being stuck in the world, save me the last bit in the
Welcome to another episode of the Social Link Podcast. This is episode 10. This is Alex.
This is Anthony.
How's it going, my man?
It is going. It's been a while since we've recorded because we've had some interesting things happen, right?
Well, you know, to say the least, I think. You know, like, I've gotten a lot of time with my PS4, thankfully, and you've gotten your time with whatever the hell you've been playing lately, but we're not going to do what you've been playing today, I don't think.
No, we're going to do something a little different. So, one thing that we carried over from the original podcast is, why not cover some pop culture every now and then, right?
Yeah, every now and then is good, but we're primarily still a video game podcast, so we want to make that absolutely clear to everybody. We are a video game podcast.
Yep. And it'll always be video games, but every now and then we'll go outside the realm of video games, which we have already done with board games, right?
Mm-hmm. We sure did.
So, instead of what you've been playing, what you've been watching, Alex?
I thought literally you were gonna be like, just, well, I think we're gonna talk about like Captain America, but okay.
Yeah.
Well, if you want to phrase it that way, I've been watching a lot of different things. Like, I mean, I am.
Oh Jesus! I opened the can of worms.
Yeah, you did. So I am at the beginning of season 4 of Breaking Bad. And okay. And as you guys may or may not know, I am an avid fan of Hannibal. And I am, you know, I guess, obsessively watching season 2 of that, and I'm really caught up. So, but my friends have been telling me all about this, you know, one series called Bates Motel, which I actually am really fascinated with. But I'm thinking, like, I'll probably finish Breaking Bad and then move towards that. So, have you heard of any of these? Have you watched any of these?
I've watched some of Hannibal. I'm still behind because I haven't had the time.
Come on. You have, like, a phone that can play Netflix.
Okay, I've been watching Arrow, though. That's been my show. Arrow's so cool. It is the best superhero show on television. There's only two.
I don't know, because after what happened with Captain America, and we're keep circling back on Captain America, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. became a completely more interesting show all of a sudden. Yeah, actually, it's funny because a lot of people who were kind of poo-pooing the show from the very beginning and stuff, like the people who actually stuck through the beginning and all that, like now they're like, yes, it's, you know, like now it's paying off, and everybody's like, holy crap, okay, this is kind of sucky. Although I have to say, and this is something that's true with Hannibal as well, the latest Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. episode was actually one of the lowest rated episodes of the show in the entire series history, which is really, really surprising to me.
Oh, because it was meant to tie in with Captain America? Oh, go watch this if you watch for Captain America.
Maybe, like, you know, they were hoping people would watch it and then watch the show. So maybe what's happening is people are DVRing it instead so that, you know, nothing is spoiled on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. It's kind of a weird experiment, you know, and I think we talked about this before, like when we were on the phone. It's a gamble. It's a huge gamble for Marvel to be able to tie in a weekly show with something that comes out, you know, every once in a while.
Here's the thing about the networks, and this is something I brought up in that very same conversation, if you recall. The networks are kind of archaic. They still go by the goddamn Nielsen ratings. Now, if you don't know how the Nielsen ratings work, many households have a Nielsen box, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the Nielsen box records, sends data, basically, of what you're watching to the networks. So they go by these Nielsen ratings, correct?
Right.
And the networks, for some reason, still go by that goddamn thing. But here's the thing about that. Not everyone has a Nielsen box. Not, and that's always been true. So a lot more people may be watching something than you're thinking they are, which is seemingly the case.
Right.
And then you're living in an era of on demand and Hulu and fucking, you know, DVR. So you got to account for those. And a lot of those now, Hulu especially, have advertising in them. So you're not losing out on anything.
Right.
You should count those, though. And that's the weird part about television, because it's not the same world it was 10 years ago, 20 years ago.
Well, you know what's interesting about that concept is that the WWE, of all things, of all companies, is realizing the value of controlling the entry point of a fan going all the way up until the end of their experience. Because a lot of companies that, you know, are much more in control of their brands and stuff, they're realizing that if you control the introduction of that person to your brand all the way up until the very end, you actually benefit greatly from them. You know, I think we talked about this. It's funny because we're bringing up a lot of things that we talk about after I get off of work. Because as you guys know, like Anthony and I talk as much as we can, like after I get off of work, I just call him on the phone. We have lots of conversations. So one of the conversations that I had with Anthony had something to do with controlling the experience of the consumer, in which case Disney is a perfect example. So in this case, you get in by watching any of their movies, watching the cartoons, Disney Channel, what have you, the entertainment medium, and then you go in and then, you know, you get to experience them at Disneyland, and then within, between the both of those, you can actually buy the merchandise. So what the WWE is actually learning is that they're not just selling wrestling on TV, they're selling an entire experience. And you saw that being done about 10 or so years ago, a little bit over 10 years ago, when they have fan events where wrestlers sign autographs and stuff, they have access events that happen before the pay-per-views. It becomes this event, this huge event. But what's really cool is it's literally the whole Disneyland thing, except they're traveling. You know, like, you go to a WWE event, you watch the wrestling, but before that, you can interact with the wrestlers and stuff.
And I've also heard that the recently WWE network has been a success in kind of doing that as well.
It's a smashing success. Within, I guess, the first few weeks of them starting the service, already like 650,000 people signed up. Mind you, their goal is 1 million by the end of the year, and they've already exceeded half of that. Yeah, and if you think about it, I mean, there is a caveat, right? Like, you have to pay $10 a month, and you have to stay on a contract for about 6 months, which pretty much, if you think about it, that's at least one pay-per-view. And what's interesting is a lot of people who watch the WWE pay-per-views and whatnot, a lot of people are expecting, like, oh my gosh, this is going to tank, because so many people are going to be watching WrestleMania, blah, 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 blah. The stream went off without a hitch. Without a hitch. Like, the service was rock solid. It never went down, and people were able to watch WrestleMania live as it was happening, which is crazy. And not only that, and this is the most amazing part, it was archived immediately, and you could watch WrestleMania 30, which is the last one, multiple times immediately.
Yep. And then I heard that there's been a lot of Ultimate Warrior stuff, considering that the Ultimate Warrior just recently passed away.
Yeah.
So, I don't follow wrestling. I did for a while when I was like 15 or something, and, you know, I got bored of it, and I never could get back into it.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of fans of wrestling, and I'm not a fan of it, but I'll say this, though. What the WWE, say what you want about Vince McMahon, there's a reason why that fucking company is as successful as it is.
He's a great businessman. I mean, when he took over the business from his dad, I mean, he really, you know, ran with, you know, the company, and it's great. It's turned out to be such a huge, you know, entertainment company. Like, it's great that they don't just think of themselves as a wrestling company now. They think of themselves as entertainment, which, you know, that's awesome in its own right.
And the thing about Vince McMahon, too, adding to what you just said, is that he has always adjusted to the times.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's always transformed the business to adapt to what the times are adapting to. So now we live in the world of on-demand and things like that, streaming internet. He adjusted that because that's a new model.
Mm-hmm. Think about it this way. Every month, there's a WWE pay-per-view. Each pay-per-view runs for between about $50 to $60 per pay-per-view. Okay. Imagine the amount of savings that you would basically get by only paying, mind you, $10 a month for 12 months.
Hold on, you get the pay-per-views too?
Yes.
Oh, shit, okay.
Not only that, the entire back catalog of the WWE, WCW, and ECW, including regional wrestling circuits. Like,
I heard...
Yeah, like, I don't know, like, I think Ohio Valley Wrestling is there too, and some of the smaller ones, including the ones in the 70s.
I heard a lot of, like, Nitro and WCW Nitro and things like that are on there.
Yes, they're still converting a lot of those things to digital, but their library is increasing. Because what they used to do is they actually... And it's funny how this turned into wrestling. We're supposed to talk about Captain America. but basically, like, what happened was that they would make DVDs and stuff, because they were selling a lot of DVDs. They do really good video packages, you know, like when they're doing like the hype towards like a match and stuff. They've been really good at that. The production values are fantastic. You can't ignore that. But what's really cool about, you know, like this is they kept on buying some of the old stock footage and stuff, because a lot of people got interested in, you know, other wrestlers before they became popular in the WWE. So naturally now they can track one wrestler's rise in their career all the way up till the very beginning, because they just kept on buying the footage. And then they release a DVD about that character, like The Rock, Stone Cold, or, you know, or Mick Foley and stuff. But ever since they started doing that, now they have this huge back catalog of content that just spans like decades of just wrestling history. So you also get that in addition to every single pay-per-view that the WWE released for only $10 a month.
Jesus.
And including, like I mentioned just now, all the pay-per-views that are coming out for free.
That is not a bad deal. That's a brilliant model.
Mm-hmm. If you think about it, if you had to pay for every single pay-per-view for 10 months, granted, you'd probably spend about, at bare minimum, about $500. Versus paying $120 a year for the entire service, and you get a back catalog.
That's a hell of a service.
That's a hell of a steal, if you think about it. But more importantly, it seems like the WWE is kind of giving a middle finger to all the cable companies out there, you know? Think about that.
That's right. And I heard most of the money that they invest in the events, such as WrestleMania, mostly comes from people who actually go to the shows.
Yeah, it's kind of like the music business, because it's like when you go to something like the, you know, like WrestleMania and stuff, they really make a lot of money out of you buying tickets for the event anyway. It's, you know, in a music industry, they don't really make too much money when you're, you know, buying the CDs or, you know, buying the songs from iTunes or what have you. They make a lot of their money like through their concerts and whatnot, you know, like they make more of their money there. Same thing with the movie industry. Like, when you buy a ticket for a movie, you're not actually, like, you know, the movie theater's not actually getting a lot of money from the movie tickets that you're buying. They're actually making a lot more money out of the concession stands, like the popcorn and drinks, which is why concession stand drinks and popcorn are super expensive. Did you know that?
Yeah, I knew that. Movie theaters and things like that, that's where most of their money comes from, so.
Yeah.
If not all of it.
Right.
So.
But that's what I'm saying, though. So, you know, like, there's a lot of ways to control experiences. And, you know, that being said, I don't know how we're going to circle back to, like, Captain America, by the way. I think we've completely tangentially, like, went to, like, one direction and completely lost our thread.
I don't know. But, hey, you know what? Even though we did, it's an important conversation to have, though, nonetheless.
Well, I like talking about the business side of things.
It is. It's important because we're seeing Netflix really kind of changed a lot of things when it decided to start streaming on consoles. Yeah. And we're seeing, you know, in reality, in a lot of ways, the WWE Network is an adoption of that ideal.
Right.
So what we're seeing is I think in some ways, the cable companies are sweating. DirecTV sweating. Because...
I was actually going to chime in because, like, I think the reason why we started this, I just kind of remembered, is because we were talking about networks and we're talking about, like, how Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. wasn't performing as well. Yeah. It is a good episode, though. A lot of people have been telling me, like, you know, like, if you didn't like the, you know, the beginning episodes of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., they really redeemed themselves with this one. Because there are members of Coulson's team that turn. And they're a pretty dramatic turn.
we'll see what happens. I'll maybe take a peek at it. I'm, like I said, hopefully it's better than that pilot and first few episodes, you know?
They've gotten better, I've heard.
Yeah. So, for me, it's Arrow all the way, though. I mean, Arrow had its hiccups, though, in the beginning, too. So, I mean, they had a club scene every episode, for God's sake.
So, club scene.
Yeah, they would have a club scene. But now it's really non-existent. And that's the tricky part about TV shows, is a lot of TV shows don't actually pick up till the end of their first season and then pick up in the second season.
That's why I like Hannibal, because they're right now in season two, they're extremely consistent when it comes to the quality of their episodes. And
yeah.
And as you know, the tableaus that they're showing become a lot more brutal.
Yep. I need to catch up on that one. That's a good show.
You totally should. We should do like an episode like in the future, and then maybe what we can do is we can talk about like, you know, I don't know, favorite serial killers in gaming? Who knows?
Favorite serial killers
in
gaming?
Something to tie that in. I don't know.
We'll figure it out.
I don't know if that would be our favorites. I'm just saying.
Do we still talk about... Can we talk about mass murderers? Because I would add Kefka to that.
I don't know.
Kefka's a mass murderer.
Yeah, but that's easy. It's just like it's just like you wave your hand. It's like, all right, everybody's dead.
He poisoned the river Doma. He blew up things.
I mean,
yeah,
that's
maybe.
Like more like a sociopath kind of thing, you know? Like, I suppose, I don't know. That's a rough call. That's a really rough call.
So how about that Captain America?
Yeah, how about Captain America, Winter Soldier? Woo!
Yay!
I liked it. I liked it a lot. It's funny because I talked to somebody at GameStop the other day, and they said, like, yeah, it's the same quality as Iron Man 2. And I'm like, what? Like, wait a second.
No. No. That guy needs... Okay, can I say my opinion? Because you know what I'm going to say.
Sure.
I think. It is the best Marvel movie. It is the best film of Phase 2, which, you know, I'm going to say this. I thought Phase 2 has been other shit of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. I have thought it has been other shit. The Avengers was this amazing film, and then all of a sudden we get Iron Man 3. Hmm. And Alex knows how I feel about Iron Man 3. And Thor, The Dark World. The problem with those movies were that, I don't know, they were trying to be serious, and then they were goofy at times. But Captain America, though, on the other hand, was
a good
extremely
balance.
It wasn't even goofy. I don't even know it was consistent the whole movie.
Mm-hmm.
The whole movie was pretty much 90% consistent, which is nice, you know.
Yeah.
I'm cool with that. Consistency, you gotta have consistency. So with Captain America the Winter Soldier, you know, you didn't have any stupid shit like, you know, Mandarins being drunk Englishmen or stupid bratty little kids or professors running around naked or stupid teleporting fucking couples making out or any stupid thing that derived the scene so badly. You didn't have anything like that, which was awesome about Captain America.
Mm-hmm.
So
I think what you're really trying to say is that there's a sense of lightheartedness to Thor and Thor the Dark World and Iron Man 3 that you feel was out of place given some of the subject matter in those movies. Like, you know, for example, like Iron Man 3, you know, like Tony Stark was suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, but here he is like being a jerk to a kid, which is funny, very funny from like a, you know, an audience mm-hmm. standpoint, but it seems to kind of, I guess, in a way, put to light like a very serious situation for him. And then in Thor the Dark World, for that matter, like, hey, by the way, your world is being destroyed, but there's this all this funny shit that's kind of happening.
You know what, here's the problem too. You kind of nailed the problem, even though I know you like those movies. Here's the problem: the other two films, or I should say in Iron Man cases, the first film was consistent in tone, but was able to maintain its humor by not being overly ridiculous.
Right.
And the same with Thor. Like, there were some hilarious scenes in the original Thor, like when he goes to the pet shop to ask for a steed and things like that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That seemed organic. It seemed like those films were organically humorous as opposed to Iron Man 3 and Thor. You know, it just seemed like they just threw in ridiculous nonsense for some fucking reason. And you get Captain America, which is a whole other beast in itself, which, again, its humor was pretty organic and shit like that.
Mm-hmm. I think, though, like, you know, and I've said this before, and I'm, you know, I'm outspoken when it comes to this. Like, out of all the new Avengers characters, you know, past Iron Man, I've always felt that Captain America was one of the strongest introductions out of that whole batch, you know, like, but of course we're talking about, like, what, Thor and Captain America, but, you know, even though Thor was pretty much, as Tony Stark would say, you know, said in Avengers, quote-unquote, Shakespeare in the Park, I mean, Captain America had a lot of heart just going into his storyline, and I think the most important thing to take here is that, you know, Captain America the Winter Soldier continued that tone that was set in the previous movie and kind of added a little bit of modern flair to it. And the most interesting part, of course, is that, you know, Steve Rogers is now fully capable of beating the shit out of a lot of people and using more modern techniques to beat the shit out of a lot of people, which is great. So now there's a basis to why he's now really super badass as opposed to just this World War II kind of reject.
Yeah. Yeah, I think here's the thing, and I've been critical of Stan Lee, but let me go back to the 60s comics real quick. One of the things that they did with Captain America that Marvel did in the 60s was when they brought back their Golden Age characters. There's a difference between what Marvel and DC, and this is important in the conversation. DC would take their Golden Age characters and modernize them as different personas, okay? Green Lantern and Flash, right?
Mm-hmm.
Flash would not be like the original Golden Age. Green Lantern would not be like the Golden Age. It would be more science fiction-y, because science fiction what was deemed the term in the 60s, right? There's an interest to what they were. In the Golden Age, the Green Lantern was magical. Now, what Stan Lee did was he just took the original Captain America stories, made them canonical, you know, not like on an alternate Earth. And I'm not saying either method is right or wrong. I like both of them, because it gives a differentiation between both companies. He took that Captain America and put him in the 60s, and he was still lost in that time frame.
Mm-hmm.
And then what was interesting was later on when Captain America would start getting his solo series. Because here's the thing. I've been a Captain America fan for since 1993, and this character has not always been popular. Seeing Captain America shirts around are fucking... It's just a kind of a shock to me, you know?
Yeah.
It's crazy, because this character was never super popular.
Right.
And if you look at his history, it's not. Captain America's modern adventures at one point were in the Avengers books. In the Avengers book, I should say, because this is late 60s. And Jack Kirby and Stan Lee were drawing, like, untold stories of the World War II era.
Mm-hmm.
So what you had here was a contrast of Captain America. And one thing that they both did very well was they showed Captain America trying to be modernized as opposed to when he was in World War II, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of those elements were maintained in the film were correct. Like, Peggy Carter is alive, you know?
Right.
But the major difference was it was easier for them to bring her back in the comics, because when Captain America premiered in Avengers 4, I think 1963, 64... there's only less than 19 years had passed since World War II
right.
At that point. So she was brought in, and in the comics throughout the 90s, she was even like kind of like a sidekick of his.
Hmm.
So it's interesting how they played with that. And then they were able to get away with things like Sharon Carter being her niece much easier than, you know...
Well, that's one thing that I really kind of appreciate, though, for, you know, the movies and stuff, is because, and this is something that, you know, that carries over with the comic books as well, and actually the video games, actually, one thing that I noticed, is that they can create, you know, like, spin-offs of these characters and have a very rich background behind them, because there's so much content written for these characters already that they can literally just cherry pick what they want from the comic books and then just kind of piecemeal them together, and then all of a sudden they make sense, you know? Like,
yep.
Come on, like, how often do story arcs happen in comic books? Like, yearly, at least, like, twice a year? I mean, that's a lot if you consider how many years, like, we've had comic books, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty crazy when you do things like that with spin-offs and stuff like that. I mean, you can explore, and that's what I think is the successful part about the Marvel Cinematic Universe, because they're exploring, you know, that comic book concept in film and television, which is an interesting, good idea, to be honest, you know? Back to Captain America, though, I will say it's an extremely faithful translation of, it's probably one of the most, it's the Captain America movie I wanted to see as a kid. Because it brought so many elements from the runs I read, particularly, I told you this, the Mark Grenwald run and the Ed Brubaker run, which are the two best runs on the book for me, followed by the Englehart run, but, you know, that's a very minor run.
I want to say itself. The Brubaker run was, like, the most critically acclaimed because Brubaker was responsible for the Winter Soldier storyline.
Yeah, yeah, the Brubaker run was, ran, fuck, to almost... I would say eight years it ran. It was an 8-year run. The Grenwald run was 10. And what was funny was those two runs kind of coexisted because Brubaker drew a lot of influence from the Grenwald run. And, of course, earlier Captain America stuff. But here's the thing with that, though, is that he, you know, he was heavily influenced. So I saw a lot of the stuff they did. One of the key examples, a Grenwald thing that was in the film, and I could be wrong... If I'm wrong, I think Grenwald created...
Let's make sure that, you know, that people have watched a movie before we do spoilers.
Oh, my bad. Okay. So...
Let's assume no one has actually seen the movie yet.
Okay. No spoilers, then.
No spoilers.
But there's a scene underground that was influenced by the Grenwald run. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes.
I think I told you... Okay, that was Grenwald. That was a Grenwald concept.
Mm-hmm.
Which is really a cool one. And Brubaker used that one, too. Another concept was, you know, the use of the Falcon was not just Grenwald and Brubaker, but was something that existed before, and Falcon was always a good supporting character.
Right.
So, I think Captain America was ultimately a faithful film, and its tone was perfect, and I mean, they borrowed a lot from the Captain America comic books.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say it was a fantastic film.
Yeah, I mean, it's really difficult to rank this out of all the Phase 2 stuff, but I mean, it is my favorite Phase 2 movie out of all the three. Like, basically, it would be this, then Iron Man, then Thor, because I'm not really. I mean. Partially because Thor is not a character that I really kind of closely identified with anyway, and then Iron Man was really good, but I feel that, you know, like, Captain America the Winter Soldier, like, was the storyline out of all the three that I really wanted to see. I mean, screw the Extremis project. I mean, that's like a, you know, I'd much rather have seen, like, you know, like the, you know, the, what is it, the Demon in a Bottle storyline.
That might have been too dark.
That would have been, it might be, but even then, with all the comedy, that would have, like, probably evened itself out. And then, you know, Thor the Dark World, it's like Malekith. I'm like, Okay, we're kind of scraping the bottom of the barrel. Like, I guess, to me, being a casual Marvel fan, it's like, okay, you're kind of scraping the bottom of the barrel here in regards to, like, bad guys for Thor. I mean, even in the old, like, 1970s, 60s cartoons and stuff, like, you know, I forget, like, what years those are. Basically, like, I back in the Philippines, I used to watch these, like, 5 or 10 minute cartoons, like, shorts.
Oh, yeah, they were actually adapted from they were actually comic book panels animated.
Yeah. They were, so basically, like, you know, like, they would always, like, have, like, Loki as the bad guy, so, you know, for Thor, and I'm like, alright, well, that's kind of cool, but, you know, that's kind of, like, one of my early introductions to, you know, the Avengers and stuff, so, but,
yeah.
But I digress, so... I really like Captain America, Winter Soldier, and the portrayal, and we were talking about this too, the portrayal of the Winter Soldier is 100% accurate with regards to, like, even his look, and of course they had to tamper a little bit with his origin, but this is still acceptable within the realm of, you know, what's happening in this whole universe, you know?
Yep, and they're setting up another villain.
Yep.
As I told you.
Villains.
Yeah.
There's a lot.
Yeah, there's Captain America, despite what people think, actually has, in my opinion, very good rogues gallery.
Yeah, I agree.
He does. He has a really, really good rogues gallery, and
it's just people are unfamiliar with it.
Yeah. It's a little unusual too. The Rogues Gallery, because a lot of it did a lot of, like, you look at Batman or something like that that is more familiar to the mainstream audience.
Mm-hmm.
You look at Batman, and that is such a fantastic Rogues Gallery. But what makes a good Rogues Gallery is if you can counter the villain, right? Same with Spider-Man's Rogues Gallery.
Mm-hmm.
Captain America's, although they're weird, they're meant to be kind of like that twisted version of Captain America.
Right.
A lot of them are like, you know, terrorists or, you know, extremists or, you know, very, very... It's a little hard to explain, but I digress.
Yeah.
So, there you go.
So, okay, so we both like the movie. Yay.
Yay.
Right.
Yeah. No more bashing of phase 2.
Oh jeez. Yeah, it's there. I am curious what you'll think of Guardians of the Galaxy, cuz you've seen the trailers, right?
Yeah, here's the thing about Guardians of the Galaxy. I'm a little skeptical of it. Those are other characters I grew up with. I used to read Warlock and the Infinity Watch, which had Drax and Gamora in it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just a very, very, very good book. It was a very, very good book, and I'm super happy with it. And I'm glad, in a way, that Marvel is actually bringing those characters. Aren't you?
Yeah, I mean, well, my take on it is that the way that they're introducing them is in a very comedic way. And it almost is a similar tone as, you know, like Iron Man 3, and to a lesser degree, like Thor, you know, because, you know, let's label Captain America as the quote-unquote serious movie out of the bunch. But I think it's deliberate, because I think what Marvel is really trying to do is, you know, they know how goofy the characters are going to be, like, perceived in Guardians mm-hmm. of the Galaxy. So their reaction is, well, we need to introduce them so that we can break people's expectations in a way that people will just accept them for what they are. But little do people know that they're actually crucial to the third Avengers movie. And assuming that Thanos appears in the third Avengers movie, we're not really sure yet.
I would assume that would be their direction, because Thanos is the villain of the Marvel universe.
Right.
You know, DC and Marvel, they have one thing in common. They have kind of this over dark god villain that is their greatest threat.
Oh.
And they're very similar, and one inspired the other, in fact. Mm-hmm. Thanos is Marvel. And they look similar in design, too, in some degrees, right?
Mm-hmm.
Thanos, they have Thanos. And I love both of them. I actually have a Thanos figure, and then I have the other guy, the DC guy, and that's Darkseid. Darkseid and Thanos and stuff. There's a very... Can I close with this? Because there's a very cool moment I want to tell you about real quick.
Sure, sure.
One of my favorite comic book miniseries is... And this is... I would love if they make a film, but it's never going to happen. Justice League of America and the Avengers crossover.
Ooh.
Considered one of the best crossovers ever written, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's one of those rare Marvel DC crossovers, and it's official. It was drawn by George Perez and all that. And just to make a long story short, you know, there's a scene where the universes are kind of tangled up, mm-hmm. and one of the goals of the characters is an Avengers villain is playing a game. His name is Grandmaster. He's playing a game with both teams. And he's saying, you have to collect at least 7 of these objects. And they're mystical artifacts, 12 mystical artifacts from the DC and Marvel universe.
Mm-hmm.
And in one of the scenes, they're on Darkseid's planet, Apocalypse. And Darkseid actually tries on the Infinity Gauntlet.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't work. Because it doesn't work with the DC universe's reality.
That's hilarious.
So it's kind of funny. And then they call him, who's this Thanos wannabe or something like that.
Oh, snap.
Yeah, so it's pretty, but it's written clever and it's not biased to either side. Mm-hmm. It shows that there's difference in contrast.
Okay.
But it is out of print for obvious legal reasons, so.
Yes. Yeah.
So there you go. Gotta leave you on that note.
Okay. So let's move on. We are actually introducing two brand new segments in this episode of The Social Link. So, do you want me to tell our listeners what they are? Well, the first one, at least.
Well, yeah, tell them, I think, well, they're your idea, and I think they're awesome ideas.
Mm-hmm.
So you should tell them about both of them, but of course, according to our schedule, we have to do the first one first, so go ahead and do that.
Well, okay, so I actually explained this a little bit better on the actual recording and stuff, but the next segment, the first segment we're going to be we're going to be introducing you to is called Drive-By. Now, I have generally like an hour commute every single day to work, so, and I've always wanted to be productive when it comes to that. Not to say that I'm going to be talking for the whole hour, but I basically recorded myself talking about video games and whatnot during my morning, early morning commute. So I may make sense, I may not make sense. So here it is, in this segment, it's called Drive-By.
Hey guys, this is Alex. Just wanted to introduce you guys to a brand new segment called Drive-By. Now, what is Drive-By? Drive-By is basically a segment that I wanted to start because, you know, Anthony having rants is pretty cool and having his reviews are pretty cool, but I'm pretty sure there's some people out there who kind of want to hear some of my opinions as well. So, you know, and it's a good way for us to kind of extend the length of the podcasts, and that's actually really cool because we do want to deliver more content to you. But the fact of the matter is that we are busy people, and we need to kind of figure out ways to extend the podcast in ways that, you know, not only uses our own time, but also uses time that maybe is unproductive. In my particular case, I have an hour drive from Los Angeles to Santa Monica on a daily basis. Naturally, it takes, you know, like, I feel like I need to do something while I'm actually, like, driving. Now, don't get me wrong, I am being safe. I actually have this on a car cradle, but the thing is, the reason why I'm explaining this to you now is so that you guys won't complain that the audio quality is actually piss poor on these recordings than it is on the regular social link episodes. But with that said, I wanted to talk about the 3DS today, specifically the 3DS XL. Now, a couple of episodes or so ago, I actually mentioned that I sold my 3DS along with my Wii U and my PSP. I was kind of heartbroken when I did trade in my 3DS. After all, I felt like this was Nintendo's premier system. I mean, between the Wii U and the 3DS, I would consider my 3DS to be the one that's most played. It's also because of its form factor. It's portable, obviously. And it, you know, Nintendo had something, you know, right to say when they basically said that mobile experiences are just very different from portable console experiences. And I still wholeheartedly agree with that, although that's quickly changing. So, when I sold my 3DS, I've always had the intention of actually replacing it, and what's really cool about this is that I did replace it eventually, and today is the day that I actually replaced the 3DS with my 3DS XL, and this is fantastic for me. This is exciting, because I felt that the 3DS actually had a lot of things going against it. One thing in particular is the size. Now, I understand that, you know, that there's, we all come in different shapes and sizes, but I've always felt that the 3DS, for the size of hands that I have, it's just a little bit too tiny for what it is. Now, I completely understand why the form factor is that way. It's easy enough to be able to put in your pocket. And, you know, and I can potentially fit it into my jeans pocket. The only thing is, it's going to be super uncomfortable because there's still this huge bulky thing there. So, there's that. But also, like, if you put your hands there, and unless you're, like, you know, somewhere between the ages of, like, I don't know, maybe 1 to, like, maybe 10 years old or something like that, it's a little bit uncomfortable. And there were times when I was playing my 3DS that it hurt to play it, especially, like, getting to the analog nub. I remember when I used to have my old 3DS and I would play Resident Evil Revelations, that it was a very uncomfortable experience. It just was not pleasant. So, you know, couple that with the fact that the analog nub on my 3DS kind of broke. I mean, it still works. If you press up on it, it'll still kind of work. But it's just, you have to apply a lot more pressure on it. It's just very difficult to deal with. It was too small for its size. So, of course, naturally, I had intended all this time to pretty much my 3DS, to get my 3DS XL. And that's really cool because when I started playing the 3DS XL, I put my, you know, my hands around it for the first time. And it felt natural. The first time ever when I held the 3DS, including the previous one I had, it felt natural. Like, it was a very natural thing to kind of have, which is really great. I loved it. You could not go wrong with that form factor. It was really bright, though, so I kind of set it down. I usually have my settings down to 2, and then I usually put it on power save mode, because just that's just the way that I am. I always use the 3DS to its max, to the limit. The thing is that I really just don't like about this whole situation, though, is that, you know, I don't have my previous 3DS's serial number, which is unfortunate because that apparently is the only way that you can actually transfer digital titles from your old 3DS to your new one. And that's really unfortunate because nowhere in any manual or whatever do they tell you that this is the case. I mean, I guess it's my fault that I traded my 3DS for the PS4, but, you know, it's just, I'm expecting Nintendo to tie all my purchases to my Nintendo account, my Nintendo ID. And unfortunately, you know, when they did implement that, you know, I had already made all my purchases that I've already done on my 3DS, therefore, they just couldn't track the purchase. But it goes without saying that you shouldn't have to have a company, you know, like, you know, you shouldn't have to call a company in order to transfer things digitally from one console to another. And that's kind of the inherent problem between, you know, like, Nintendo and everybody else, is that, you know, in my case, and I have a special case because I did sell my platform before I actually, you know, like, before I actually got my 3DS XL, for obvious reasons. You know, this shouldn't be the case. Like, you should have, like, kind of a list of things that you've already purchased, and pretty much applying that across consoles. And kind of like, you know, the Vita and the PS4 and the PS3. You would think that the company would be interested in your spending habits and whatnot. You know, not to say that that's a good thing, per se, but this is one of those moments where I kind of wish they did. I kind of wish that they actually knew what they were doing, and I kind of wish that, you know, they'd kept track of, like, all the things that I bought from the very beginning, because now I'm like, I have a Wii without any of the digital downloads that I have, because, you know, of course, now I sold my Wii U. And, of course, now I have a 3DS XL that has no digital copies. Now, this is sad to me, because, like I said, I do consider the 3DS as, like, my primary platform. But now, because of what happened to me, there's a general apprehension with purchasing digital games. Digital is something that everybody is going to move to. And as much as I hate to admit it, the only limitations that we have in terms of digital is bandwidth. And the sad part is that I'm scared to buy anything digital from Nintendo, because I know that it has a finite life. It's not going to last forever. And I know that it's only going to be tied to my platform. This saddens me. You know, like, last night, I was actually, like, tempted, you know, regardless of Anthony's suggestion, to actually buy Pokemon X and Y. But you know what happened? I actually convinced myself not to. Because if I ever bought that, that would be $40 down the drain that I will never see again. In the event that, oh, I don't know, maybe Nintendo created a brand new 3DS that, you know, had newfangled features, much better features. So that saddens me, and I can't do any sort of impulse purchases. Now, this is not to my detriment. I know that I shouldn't spend a lot of money. Heck, I bought my 3DS XL using, you know, my credit card because they extended the credit limit. But that's not the point here. The point is that how much I love the 3DS XL and the 3DS in general, there are things that Nintendo still needs to work on. They need to understand that they need to have a Western sensibility in order to provide a lot of great conveniences, you know, towards its customers. I know that they've been ravaged by emulation over the past few years, but that still doesn't mean that you can't provide, like, you know, a solution that everybody else is already offering. And that's kind of the disconnect that I have with Nintendo, is that they are trying to be a very modern company, but they keep wanting to reinvent the wheel. Why don't you just take somebody else's wheel and put it on yours? You don't have to make everything your own way. And who knows? Maybe you'll discover that there's, you know, like, those solutions are probably the best way to go, because not only are you servicing your consumers, but it probably is just good practice anyway.
And there you have it, the very first drive-by segment. So what did you think, Anthony?
I thought it was cool. You know, you're driving from work, you're giving me your thoughts on your 3DS, and I am glad you're liking the XL a little bit more than you do the regular 3DS, right?
Oh my god, thank goodness. I mean, I don't have to rehash what I said on drive-by, but holy crap, like, I felt like, I seriously felt like when I was playing the 3DS, like the small one, that I was developing carpal tunnel. That is terrible.
It's much more comfortable, isn't it? Because, you know, we've said before, I recently got one about almost 2 months ago.
Oh, did you? Did you? Like, was it really just 2 months ago?
Uh-huh. February. Remember? I got one.
Oh, yeah. It's great. I couldn't wait for, like, the, you know, the, what is it? The Mickey one that came out for Walmart. I just couldn't wait. I was just like, you know what? I'm just gonna get it. But, you know, like I said in the drive-by, though, I will never, ever buy a digital thing ever again from Nintendo, because guess what? I can't transfer any of my games anymore from Nintendo to
the 3DS. Do you have the card?
No.
The card from your old 3D? God damn it.
Nope. I shouldn't have to do that. It should just be... I mean, if they're tracking my information in Nintendo Club, they should just be like, oh, you bought all these games. Well, here you go.
You know. I agree. It's a bit archaic. I don't like the way Microsoft did it either with the 360 at one point.
Mm-hmm.
They were both clunky. The only ones that seem to get it are like Steam or Good Old Games or fucking PSN. You know, they seem to get it.
Well, Sony was it. What was interesting is that here's a trick, right? And I don't know if this works on the PS4, but what you can actually do is you can actually hook up your account on your friend's PS3 or PS4, I think, and then when you sign into their account, you can actually download their games, and everybody on that system can actually play those games.
Yep, I know that. That is awesome. That's what Sony's pretty awesome about it.
Yeah, they're not like, oh, well, you're not gonna buy games, blah blah blah. They know their audience. That's a lot of trust, actually. If you think about it.
That is a lot of trouble. And then remember, they used to have it where you could have 5 systems that could download your stuff.
Yeah, I think it was up to 6, right? Total?
Mm-hmm. No, it was 5 at 5. Now it's only 2, but oh, okay. I mean...
Still not bad.
Well, there's a catch with that, too. Any games before November 2011, you can still do up to 5 accounts.
Ah, interesting.
And there's a lot of stuff that came out before then, so... And
of course, mean 2 consoles?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It's pretty cool. I don't know. I do buy a lot of digital stuff from Nintendo. That's just because it's for convenience, but I understand your frustration. I am glad I was able to transfer my stuff from my old 3DS to my new one. I have a 16 gig card in there. So,
Yeah, my situation is different from yours. I was not upgrading from a 3DS to a 3DS XL. I was literally, like, I sold my 3DS, then my 3DS XL, I bought it later when I could afford it. And that's the sad part, is because there is absolutely no way, because here's the thing, right? They said that in order for me to get all my shit back, I needed to, get this, know the serial number of the 3DS I traded in. I'm like, what? Really? Really? So there is absolutely... Yeah, there's no other way. There's no other way that I can actually get my games anymore. I needed to know beforehand, or somehow I needed to be like a fortune teller to know that I needed to know that the serial number of my previous, you know, 3DS. Which is crazy to me.
Okay.
And this is exactly what I was telling you about the other day, and you were like, no, I was able to do it. I'm like, no, I doubt it. I really doubt it. And this is the proof. This is proof in the pudding. You cannot deny this now.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah.
So you proved it. You proved it.
Yep. And, you know, I spent like $200 to prove it.
Well. But
that being said, 3DS XL is pretty great.
I love the screen.
You know, I want to say that I do, but the thing is, like, when I was playing, when I play games on it, it is brighter. It is a lot brighter. The quality is kind of on par with the regular 3DS. It's just bigger. But, you know, it's funny because now that it's a bigger screen, now that I'm now I'm wishing that it's kind of like an old LED screen like the PS Vita, because it's still doing the scan line thing that, you know, that a lot of old TVs used to have. And it's like, I can't play, you know, Bravely Default, like, for an extended period of time at all because of that, because it just hurts my eyes, you know? I don't know if you've ever experienced that.
No, I haven't.
Huh. Well.
Maybe I'm used to it. I don't know. Something's wrong with me.
Because, I mean, we're talking scan lines. We're talking constant flickering. I mean.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, I don't know how far you're actually, you know, if you're doing 3D, if you're not doing 3D. I don't know.
I'm not doing 3D. Okay. I never do 3D, rarely. Okay. Maybe, but.
Yeah. I mean, I did, you know, I checked it out. It's still good. I mean, I'm glad I still have my 3DS games, you know, like. And some for some reason, I still have, like, Kid Icarus. I guess I'm kind of just hanging on to that fucking game, like, because I'm hoping I will magically like it.
Kid Icarus?
Yeah. Even though I've expressed my hatred towards that game multiple times.
We both have expressed our hatred for that game. That's one of the few games you and I hate together.
Yeah, for some reason, I still have it. I don't know.
Remember 2 years ago when it came out, everyone's like, it's so cool, and I'm like, it's not a very good game.
Yeah, the controls are very gimped. This is what you get for not having two sticks. This is awful.
Yeah.
And of course, there's a lot of Nintendo apologists. Anyways, so, that being said, we actually have a review for you, right?
Yes, we do.
Which is surprising. Yes, we have back-to-back reviews, like, because I think you reviewed Bravely Default the last time.
Mm-hmm.
And this this week, what is it?
Final Fantasy X. Now only Final Fantasy X.
Okay. So do you want to kind of introduce it a little bit then?
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so I finished Final Fantasy X from the HD re-release, and I basically want to talk about it. Can you do me a favor, actually, too?
What?
Alex? Can you? Because I would like people to see my old review to kind of compare how my opinions have changed again on this game.
Oh, jeez.
Can you, and I'll get it to you, can you post the link to my YouTube review?
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, definitely.
Okay.
Just kind of email it to me and stuff, and I'll post it. Okay. What I'll do is, and this is for people who are actually listening to this podcast right now, you'll need to go to the Gamer Horizon website and actually click on the link, because it's not going to show up on your podcast you know, player or whatnot. You do need to go to our website and actually click on the link if you're curious. If not, you know, obviously you can listen to his review, his current one. So
yeah, yeah. And I just want it up there just for maybe a little bit of comparison there. So
mm-hmm. Okay. So
there you go. So let's do it.
Okay. I was like waiting for you to actually transition it. I'm like, so how are you going to transition this?
Let's do it. Let's do it. Let's just play the bitch.
Okay.
Hello, guys. So I got a review for you today. Now, mind you, this is only Final Fantasy X and the Eternal Calm video that plays that you can get. That was on the International Edition that we got recently. We never got international version of Final Fantasy X here until this HD re-release, which was released a few weeks back, about 3 weeks ago or so, like that, something like that. So, with that said and done, my friends, I think it is time to talk about Final Fantasy X and give you a review of what this game is about. Now, hopefully in the near future, I'll do a review of X-2. I want to talk about X, though, because as I mentioned before with my discussions with Alex on the podcast, I have an interesting love-hate, that type of relationship with this game. With that said and done, Final Fantasy X, I hated when it first came out. Maybe that I was rushed through the game because I was borrowing someone's PS2, whatever. You know, didn't care for it back then. Liked it a lot more in 2010 when I played through it. Loved it in 2010, I should say. But it wasn't one of my favorite Final Fantasies. Now that I replayed it, it is my number 2 Final Fantasy because this game just packs a punch. Now, here's the deal. here's the deal about this game, and I'm not going to do any spoilers in terms of the story, because it's just, in case you've never played this game, and this is your chance to play this fucking game, play it in HD glory, it is amazing, amazing fucking game. So, with that said and done, let's talk about a few things about this game. And hopefully, I'm going to ask Alex to post a link to my old Final Fantasy X review, and you can see how my opinion has changed since those early, since those days, which was fucking 4 years ago. So, with that, here's the deal. Here's the deal, guys. Final Fantasy X is a game that, in terms of graphics, was very good for PS2. It set a couple tones. It was the first Final Fantasy with voice acting. I'll admit the voice acting is spotty at times, but it is usually good. It's not horrible, but there are spotty elements of it. As far as Final Fantasy X goes as well, too, its soundtrack is one of Uematsu's best. I believe the guy who also did Final Fantasy XIII soundtrack also did this soundtrack as well. It was the first Final Fantasy that was not completely done by Uematsu. It is just fucking awesome. So with that said, and I'm saying with that said a lot, but that's okay because there's a lot to be said about this fucking game. You know, graphically, the game looks good. I will say there are some noticeable differences because I do own the Vita and the PS3 version. PS3 version does run a little slightly smoother. Vita actually suffers from some slowdowns at times. But that's okay. Nothing to break the game, nothing like that. Character models are redone. They look really nice. I know there's some controversy. I think they look really good. Very detailed. However, only the main sevens have been done, and unfortunately the NPCs have been neglected like redheaded fucking children. Stepchildren. What the fuck am I saying? Redheaded stepchildren. Yes, they have been, because they all look blocky as fuck. But I will say one thing that this game graphically has aged well is its backgrounds. Its backgrounds look fucking great, you know? The lightning plains, the Guado City, all of that, the far plane sequences, the FMVs have aged very, very well. So Final Fantasy X, in some aspects, graphically have aged well, in other aspects, not so much. I understand why they didn't do the NPCs, because that would take a lot of time, because there's a lot of fucking NPCs in this game. So, there you go on that aspect. Now, let's talk about the gameplay. The gameplay has aged very well. It has aged perfectly. This is a very playable game today. The sphere grid system is awesome. It's kind of like a mini board game you could play around, stuff like that. It's awesome. And I'm not going to say it's just awesome. You know, you move your characters on the sphere, gain abilities. It's not a typical level-up system. What's cool about it is you can play with it, though. The way the game is set up, early game, it's very interesting because it emphasizes that you use all your characters, switch them around. And even throughout the rest of the game, it does. Because what's cool about it is if you use all your characters in battle, you get more AP to build up spheres levels. The other tricky part is to find spheres in the game that let you do tricky part. You can teleport to other parts in the board, you know, you can unlock black spheres, you know, black magic spheres, whatever. It is fucking cool as shit. So it is a neat level up system. It's a lot of fun to play with. You can spend a lot of time playing just on the sphere grid. It's kind of like you have to make decisions. It's really a cool level up system. Story-wise, the story is fantastic. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail, but it deals with the subject of death, you know, and its theme is the spiral of death and breaking that spiral of death, and, you know, goes into religion and, you know, love and what is existence and are we real and dreams and all that type of shit. The reason I don't want to go too much in the story, though, is because I know a lot of people haven't played it. You need to play this game. There are some plot twists in this game that are just amazing. And that ending, holy fuck. That ending. That ending is one of the few that brings me the fucking tears. I'm serious. That ending is just amazing. Here's some of the bad things. One thing that did not change from the last two times is I fucking hate Blitzball. I tried it. I actually played it more extensively than I have in any time, and I don't know. It's kind of droll. You get your ass kicked a lot. It's maybe I'm not playing it right, and even if I did, and when I win, I'm like, eh. You know, it's kind of meh, you know? know, it doesn't have the charm of the card games that Final Fantasy IX or VIII had. You know, it's just not very interesting. Some of the side quests are weird. There's one where you have to dodge 800 lightning bolts. No, not 800, 200 lightning bolts in a row on the lightning planes. It's a very... There's some odd stuff to do in it. There's also some odd decisions, too, with... We got the Dark Aeons. And if anyone wants to correct me if I'm wrong, but I tried to go back to Besaid at the end game, and I was attacked by a Dark Aeon, which are basically the equivalent of Ultima weapons in this game, and I got fucking destroyed. And I wanted to get Besaid to do another side quest, and I couldn't even enter the fucking city. So if I'm completely wrong on that, please, please let me know if there's another way to enter. But other than that, that's a couple of the game's flaws. But other than that, Final Fantasy X is a masterpiece of a game. It has a couple little minor flaws, in my opinion. The Eternal Calm video, you don't need to watch it. I remember it was much hyped at the time it was released because it was a prelude. But everything that is said about in that thing is said much better in Final Fantasy X-2 from the little bit I've seen. So, you know, don't worry about that. It's not really kind of redundant, if anything else, you know? So with that said, I will give Final Fantasy X-10 by itself, though, a 9.5 out of 10. Even though it sounds like I had a lot of flaws with it, the overall experience is amazing. There's a lot to do in this game. You know, there's chocobo stuff, there's some side quest stuff, the characters' backstories are fleshed out, there's some side quests that explain more of their backstory. It is just a fucking awesome game. So, 9.5 out of 10. Thanks, guys, and now on with the show.
So what did you think, Alex?
Pretty much, very surprising that you said that this is now like your second favorite Final Fantasy. I was really surprised when you mentioned that. I mean, I know I want to say you mentioned that before. I'm not sure if you did on the podcast, but actually hearing you say it like on this review was kind of surprising to me still.
Well, you know, I'm pretty critical of Final Fantasies. Even though I like 13, it's not in my top 5.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I will say this about the series, though, is that it's a series that can affect you in many ways in different ways of your life. And I think that's the beauty of that series, is there's some sort of emotional connection in pretty much every game of it. I mean, maybe with the exception of the first one, because we're Light Warriors and we need to save the crystals, you know? But yeah. Every one of them has some sort of connection. Don't you agree?
Sure.
Yep. And I love Final Fantasy X. I loved it this third time that I played it. So the third time. The only thing, like I said, is Blitzball can go fuck itself.
Yeah. I actually have like maybe a couple people say like we love Blitzball. I'm like fuck you.
Give me what was that fucking card game?
Triple Triad?
Yeah, give me fucking Triple Triad. That was fun. I played too much Triple Triad.
Yeah. It's pretty... It's decent. I just don't like mini-games in my Final Fantasies. Give me the actual... You know, give me the actual battles. I don't give a shit about these mini-games.
I don't mind mini-games. Some of them are really good, like... Well, I'll be honest. I like visiting Gold Saucer.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's different, you know, like it's like a bunch of smaller mini games and stuff, which isn't half bad, but the novelty wears off. Oh, you mean something off. No, I'm talking about like a very in-depth like mini game, like, you know.
Oh.
Like Triple Triad is one of them, and then of course, you know, you have Blitzball, which is just way too plotting. I mean, it's just way too slow for me.
Fucking Blitzball is like you watch that intro video in Final Fantasy X and they're fucking knocking each other out and shit. Yeah. And you're like, yeah, it's fun. Blitzball is awesome. Then you actually play and you're like, oh, fuck.
Like they're all swimming around like randomly. It's like bloop, bloop, bloop. I'm like, no, this is not what I signed up for. The freaking this is video not what's... is cooler.
Yeah, this is not what was in the fucking. Because you're like, yeah, I get to play that cool shit I saw, and then it's not really that cool.
It's not really that cool. And the sad part is, like, you know, of all the... And I was talking to the Gamer Horizon crew about this on the chat today, and I said, this is in stark contrast to the quickness of the battle system of Final Fantasy X. I mean, holy shit, like, it's, like, Final Fantasy X's battle system is so fucking fast, and then you have this game where it is literally the equivalent of watching paint dry.
That sucks.
Yeah, that's blitzball to you. It's like bloop, bloop, bloop. Oh, you're getting blocked. What are you going to do? Oh, I'm going to get hit. Blop, blop, blop. Oh, look, you're swimming the other direction again. Swim, 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 swim. And I'm like, oh, Jesus Christ, really? We're going to do this right now?
It doesn't give you a bunch of options.
No, it's just, it is half-baked. I mean, people love it. I don't give a shit. Like, I just don't have a good experience with it. Speaking of Final Fantasy, I have a take on Bravely Default, which you actually reviewed last week. And I'm going to take this time to actually introduce our new segment called Shooting from the Hip. So the term, of course, is, you know, taken from when you're like playing like an FPS, or, you know, like you're actually shooting a real gun and stuff, and you're not actually aiming. You're just kind of like, you know, pulling a gun from your holster and then blam, blam, blam. You're not really like,
yeah,
you know, like aiming too well. So this particular segment pertains to the fact that I myself or Anthony might have probably played a game for a few minutes or a few hours, and we're kind of wanting to give you a very good impression of what we feel is the game within the first few minutes and first few hours. Now, why are we doing this? Well, and I explain it a little bit more in detail in the actual recording, but I feel that some of the first few moments of games are extremely important. As, you know, I think I discovered this more and kind of remembered this when I started playing Infamous, which, you know, Second Son specifically, where it gave me a really, really good first impression the first few hours, and then it just devolved into this kind of drawl kind of experience. It's like kind of like really slow and lethargic, and it's like, okay, that's where Infamous was hiding all this time. It is still Infamous, you know. So we want to capture all that kind of excitement or pessimism that we usually have coming into a game, and then kind of maybe later on and stuff, if we do get to finish the game, kind of do a full review on it, so that you'll know and you'll see, like, if there is a disconnect between your first few minutes or hours of experience versus the overall, you know, like, experience of a game. Because let's face it, Sean, you know, from the crew was telling me, like, you didn't even, you know, play a little bit more until you got to Neon. And I'm like, look, dude, if somebody told me to play an RPG up until hour 20 to find where the fun button is, that is not a good game. Really, now. Like, you're going to make me fucking play this game and I already hate it? That is bullshit. Bullshit. That doesn't deserve my time. Traded it in. So.
Oh, shit.
So,
yeah, you were not happy with that game.
If you're an Infamous fan, you're going to love it. But if you want to be an Infamous fan, you're going to hate it.
Yep. That's the way it usually goes.
Yep. So in any case, just to reiterate, for our first Shooting from the Hip segment, we are actually featuring Bravely Default. So here it goes.
Hey guys, this is Alex. I just wanted to welcome you to a brand new segment that we're introducing called Shooting from the Hip. Now, what is this segment? Well, I'm hoping that Anthony and I will take advantage of this segment to talk about some of the games that we've been playing but haven't really finished. And I feel that writing reviews on games that we haven't completed yet isn't necessarily fair. Granted, there are times, like with Anthony's Bravely Default review, that he's played enough of the game to be able to give it a fair shake and a fair score. But in my particular case, I play a lot of different games, like a lot of smaller games and, you know, a lot of lengthy games as well. And usually I'm very, very critical of them. So I kind of decided that why not? Maybe if we shoot from the hip and play it, you know, play a game for several minutes or several hours, maybe, you know, we can provide some more information to people that, you know, are probably still on the fence after hearing our reviews of the games. So pretty much, that's what this segment's all about. So, for my first segment, I actually wanted to talk about Bravely Default. And I know that Anthony has already provided his review, but I feel like that there are parts of the game that were not represented by his review because of the nature of his rants and what have you. So, I wanted to give kind of like a little bit of a better overview of the game than him, and at the same time provide my opinions. Now, if you're a casual RPG gamer, whether it's JRPG or Western RPG, you know, this is kind of like in the middle road with regards to converting you, so to speak. The reason why I say this is because it is a very, very, very traditional JRPG. Now, it has random battles, it has a job system that practically would qualify this game as a Final Fantasy, and a lot of other elements, too, that, you know, that keep it within its, you know, traditional background. But the more interesting thing about this game is that, unlike most of its predecessors, like, in regards to the genre itself, it allows you to actually dynamically adjust the difficulty of the game. So, for example, if you want the enemy smarter, you'd basically, like, set the difficulty from normal, which is what I played in, to high, or to low, whatever the settings are. In addition to this, you can also set the encounter rate to a +1 or a +2 or a -1 or a -2. Or actually +50%, +100%, or -50%, -100%. Now, this is interesting to me because it actually helps a lot with grinding, and Anthony has already covered that in his review. So let's say you actually got out and stuff and, you know, you can't beat a boss. And mind you, like, I've played 4 hours of this game and I've actually found myself to grind a bit. You do need to grind. But having the encounter rate increased and actually having the difficulty be variable is actually very welcome. And I think that's a way for them to kind of bridge the gap between casuals and hardcore JRPG fans. But to some degree, unless you're really familiar with JRPG mechanics, a lot of these probably won't make a lick of sense. So that's why I'm kind of explaining it to you again. In Anthony's review, he also talked about the job system. What he didn't actually talk about in detail is actually the sub-job equipment system. And what that is you can pick a job, a primary job, where you can gain a job points on, and then you can equip a sub job, like a secondary job, where you can actually use its abilities, you know, without penalty. And you can also actually equip a kind of stat bonus that is unlocked when you're playing that particular job. That eventually unlocks, like, the more you play that particular job, the more you level it up. I've only played all of the jobs that are available to me, which is the Black Mage, the White Mage, and the Monk, all the way up until level 3. So unfortunately, I don't really know if there's anything past that other than what I'm already aware of. Again, I've played this for 4 hours. It's probably not enough to review this. But what's interesting about this is that once you do equip your primary job, all your equipment and whatnot won't be taken out of you. Now, what does that mean? There are different weapon and armor proficiencies based off of the job that you are actually equipped on. And what's interesting about this is that the sub-jobs don't really apply to it. And that's actually one of the reasons why you want to equip a, you know, sub-job as a main job in order to level it up. Because in order for you to use any of the higher level spells, for example, or at higher level skills, you'll need to level up that particular job. Now, I've mentioned that you do gain job levels, and based off of what I can tell, you get maybe one job experience point or job point per enemy. That's not really ideal sometimes. But what's really cool in the game is that the game actually keeps track of your performance during battle. So, for example, if you actually win the round win the battles that you're in within the first round, you get extra points in your experience and your job level and your job experience points. If you get through a first round in battle unscathed, you also get additional bonus points. So it's really cool that the game actually rewards you for not being sloppy in battle. And also, we were talking earlier about grinding. It's actually not that bad. You usually have to take, like, maybe about, at most, maybe 10 minutes if you set the encounter rate up to, like, 100% in order to, like, really take advantage of those features and grind all the way up to the level that you desire. But that being said, the job levels are still very tenuous and very tedious to level up, given that, of course, you can only get 1 point per monster, which, let's face it, the most you probably face is about 2 or 3. And if you're, like, at level 3, where you're trying to level up to level 4 by, I don't know, getting up to, like, 150 points, that's a little bit of a pain in the ass. So I'm hoping that later on in the game, they'll get a little bit more generous with regards to job points and whatnot, because, let's face it, I need to level up a shitload of other jobs. You know, I want to get them to, like, a decent level, because leveling up my character is actually, like, you know, well, not that fun. That's not true, actually. The battle system is actually really fun. It can get really fast. And what's interesting about this is that it is a turn-based battle system, but rather, it's really quick. It does feature a feat, like a feature, wow, that's really redundant, where you can set the battle speed really, really fast. And that's helpful, again, because if you're trying to grind, you don't want to spend some time, like, staring at each other into oblivion until, you know, somebody else moves. And Anthony has already covered the bravely and the default and the default functionality of the game. Default is interesting because it allows you to block at the same time get an extra battle point, which determines how many turns you can do in a game. Now, in order to activate these battle points, you need to use Brave. And that's actually a really cool kind of functionality in the game. But I found them really kind of odd because you'll face enemies later on that can practically, like, put a good dent on you. And, you know, sometimes, you know, using the default strategy and then just kind of building it up, you know, does not work out the way that you expect it to. In fact, you know, there was one of the boss battles that I fought within the 4 hours of the game. I actually, you know, was, you know, given a smattering of, like, poison spells. And, you know, it's kind of difficult to make a strategy based off of that, especially since they don't give you a lot of equipment to kind of mitigate that, or even enough, you know, they do give you the spells to be able to do it, but it's like, it's kind of like this weird balance of, like, well, okay, well, that's kind of nice that, you know, like, I can mitigate that and stuff, but it's like, you know, it's really weird, the way that the battle system is handled, and I'm still kind of getting a grips of it. Originally, I was thinking, like, maybe if I get my white mage enough brave points and stuff, she can actually, like, you know, cast a bunch of, Poisona spells, again, Final Fantasy nomenclature, and, you know, kind of prevent them from, you know, from getting chipped with damage. I mean, in other words, like, the battle system is, you know, for me, at the very least, a love or hate. So far, I'm really appreciating it for all the kind of customization that they're giving traditional JRPG players to, you know, in order to do the deed of grinding. But at the same time, I feel that casual RPG gamers might want a little bit more of a meat with regards to, like, some of the battle systems. Because, let's face it, it is a Final Fantasy game with a different skin. With regards to the storyline, I find the storyline very interesting. It is very Final Fantasy Final Fantasy V-ish with regards to its storytelling, with smatterings of, you know, team-based dialogue play. And we're not talking, it's not really gameplay when it comes to the team dialogue. It's called party chat. You activate it by hitting the Y button when you're on the world map or, you know, exploring or what have you. And it basically, like, has this conversation that happens between each of the party members, which is interesting and provides additional color to them. With regards to the voice acting, yes, this game does have voice acting. The only times that it doesn't have voice acting is when you're exploring town or in party chat. Otherwise, big sections of the game, like, you know, cutscenes and what have you, which are well done, by the way, they're not cheesy. They're a welcome addition to the game. I certainly didn't expect that. Anthony completely, like, neglected it. But it's welcome. It's not the best, but it's certainly better than Final Fantasy X. With regards to the graphics, they are fantastic. They're probably some of the most beautiful, hand-drawn, almost watercolory artwork I've ever seen in a 3DS game. And that really speaks volumes to the kind of quality that this game has. The character models are very reminiscent of the Four Warriors of Light video game, and that's not a bad thing. The game is very much stylized with its presentation, very similarly to previous games that Yasumi Matsuno kind of worked with the artist with, which is Vagrant Story and Final Fantasy XII. That's not a bad thing. That means there's a visual consistency between everything in the game. In fact, you know, a lot of the buildings and the structures and whatnot, you might even think that that's from those games, but it's not. So, I guess what I'm trying to say here with my shooting from the hip segment is that I still really like the game, and I'll definitely give it a chance. But there are some times that are, that some points of the game, rather, that are very trying for me. Specifically, some of the battles in the battle system, but maybe it's because I'm playing wrong. Maybe we can talk about it on the podcast after, like, I post this. But pretty much, I would probably recommend this for a lot of fans of traditional JRPGs. But with regards to casual JRPG fans, you might want to note that it does lean a little bit more towards traditional, and some of the niceties don't really warrant any sort of, like, innovation or what have you. It's just a convenience. So, there you go. And hopefully, we'll be talking about this on the podcast right after this.
Alright, so that's pretty much my impressions of Bravely Default.
It seemed like you liked the depth of the system, though.
Yeah, I am just scared that it's going to be repetitive. And the only reason why I say this is because I am doing a lot of grinding right now. And I really like the kind of optimizations, I guess, so that they can turn this traditional RPG into something that is more time manageable. But it's not friendly for casual JRPG people, and I covered that extensively in my shooting from the hip segment.
Mm-hmm.
It really is, in its bare bones, a traditional RPG. It's as traditional RPG as you can get. I mean,
yep.
You know, we're talking like, if you're dead in a battle, you will stay dead. If you have a status effect, you will stay with that status effect. And boy, that is a lot of fucking grinding. I mean, you know, it is crazy. Like, I had to fucking spend like a grand to get like 10 fucking Phoenix Downs, because I literally spent all of it like with the second boss battle, the night on the airship. Yeah, that was like, oh my god, okay, several of my people are dead, I've pretty much practically used all my Phoenix Downs, and, you know, and just to kind of add to my, you know, segment, one of the things that I really hate about these games, and I don't know why they don't do this, you know, because they do premeditate it, you know, for a lot of other kinds of games, right? Is
right.
They never tell you what's coming up next. So you're grinding all this time, getting to level 3 for a job, only to find out that the next level is only going to give you a stat bonus.
Oh, yeah.
Which is why, again, I think this is why I love Final Fantasy X and the gap, and the Sphere Grid system, but also the License Grid system in Final Fantasy XII, because you know what you're getting. They're practically the same. You know, I mean, pretty much at this point. And the thing is, in most other RPGs, you're like, hey, Mystery, you're getting this. And I'm like, I really don't need that. I need you to make me more powerful and all that stuff. And I felt like those two systems were great, and I've never found a system that's similar to that. And yes, Persona 4 is like one of my favorite games of all time, JRPGs for that matter, but, you know, it adds another layer of complexity to it, which is, you know, in order to get the stuff that you want, you need to mix and match different things, but they give you the proper tools to kind of know, like, okay, well, if you mix those two things, you get this, and these are the spells that you get, you know? But in this game, it's just like, oh my god, okay, so you get the skill called Treat. What the fuck is that? It's like, oh, you get a little bit of HP. I'm like, that's so great! I spent hours fucking leveling the Freelancer up only to get that.
Yeah, then, but here's the thing about that game I will defend, though. Once you get more jobs, it becomes more fun to fucking mix and match.
Yeah, so. But, like, I don't want to spend hours leveling up just to find out that I get another fucking stat bonus. I want a fucking new ability. I want something that will make me want to play this class more. Like even now, like, I'm heading towards the Temple of the Wind. I feel useless. I have all my jobs at level 3 and stuff for each of the different characters. I haven't classed them appropriately, mind you. But even then, I'm just kind of like, okay, they're all kind of like level, I don't know, 12, 13 right now, and they're still kind of useless. Like, when I started fighting, like, enemies in that desert, one of my characters just fucking fell dead. And I'm like, okay, so everybody gets poisoned really easily, and I'm like, oh, okay, this is, I don't know, like, this is becoming like a pain in the ass all of a sudden. It's like, you know, I don't even know if I'm playing. It's one of those cases where it's too traditional that I don't know if I'm doing things right.
Yeah. Yeah. I think maybe that's why I liked it, but you know what?
Told me to get this game. Shame on you.
I know. It's a good game. Oh, are we going to do Sekiro Samurai all over again?
Well, okay, we're leading into our JRPG revival talk anyway.
Okay.
So, I mean, you know, so we kind of talked on the phone about JRPGs being revived, and I have my own opinions of it, but Bravely Default is the perfect segue into this because it did kind of make Square Enix kind of turn around and say, hey, look at that. That sold a lot of copies. It sold more copies than our big budget Final Fantasy 13. Why is that?
Lightning Returns, to be exact.
Lightning Returns, to be exact, yes.
Yeah. Yes, sir, yes, sir. Which I have, but haven't played for some reason. I don't know why. But you know what? What was cool about... Look, here's the thing about Bravely Default. I think it's a game where you have to dedicate a lot of it, and I'm pretty overpowered in that game, I'll be honest with you, so back combat's pretty easy for me.
Mm-hmm. I mean, okay, but what level were you at when you got to, you know, when you were heading towards the Temple of the Wind?
Probably like 20.
Jesus Christ. Wow. Okay, I guess I'm severely underpowered then, holy shit.
But it was too easy for me too, though.
Okay, so, okay.
And I did a lot of grinding in it. Not right now, I'm in chapter 3, and I was told I'm way overpowered, which is, I'm level 47, so.
How many chapters are there in that game?
8 chapters.
Oh, wow, okay, yeah, you're, like, pretty much halfway through the entire thing.
Yeah, and I'm like, you know, I think it goes to 99, I could be wrong.
Yeah, I hope.
Yeah, but,
Anyways, let's steer this towards the discussion.
Yeah. Yeah, okay, so I believe, and I've kind of changed my opinion on this, JRPGs are on a revival. I've said this 2 years ago. I think the Japanese companies are making a little bit more effort in some ways. We're actually getting Tales games here because Namco realized, oh, there's a fucking audience for it. You know, Square Enix finally realized, you know, oh, we could do more traditional stuff. And we have this weird blend of JRPG... and Western mentality going into it in an indie front. So, for example, Child of Light, right? I'll admit, I pre-ordered it.
Wait. This was the stance that I was telling you about when we were on the phone.
Yes, but I thought about it. Here's the thing.
Okay, so let me give a background on that first. So, okay. We've been talking, obviously, Anthony and I have been talking about JRPGs for quite some time. And I argued for years. But for the past several months, I came to an epiphany with, you know, a lot of the rise of indie gaming. And of course, even with Anthony's, you know, gameplay, how should I say this, patterns. You know, I would have never imagined him to, you know, saying that he liked Saturday Morning RPG. I mean, to me, that game was a piece of crap. But, you know, to him, like, he really loved it. And mind you, that was a JRPG that was not created by a Japanese company.
Nope, it wasn't.
And then that's where I came to this epiphany where, well, what if the best JRPGs were suddenly created by the West? And that's when I started researching about, like, what other people are doing, people meaning developers, and I'm slowly discovering that they're slowly starting a takeover of the genre. And so, you know, Anthony and I have been kind of going back at this, which, you know, which is why I kind of told him, like, well, if you look at Child of Light, that is the West trying to basically, mm-hmm. like, own a genre that pretty much the Japanese, I should say, is somewhat creatively bankrupt with regards to their, you know, their stylization. Because one thing that we came to a conclusion with is the reason why a lot of JRPGs are being ignored is because the actual art style is homogenized across several different games. So, for example,
NIS is guilty of this.
But also Tales, because, for example, all of the Tales games are all anime-based. Like, you see some of their, you know, promotion stuff. It's like you see them in anime style and their cutscenes, which is fine if you're releasing this game only in Japan and want to make money only in Japan. But to a casual JRPG gamer, you know, which there are people. There are people who are casual JRPG gamers. They would just look at it and say, it looks like the same as the other games. And when you're paying $60 for a game, that's actually very difficult. That's a very difficult sale, you know? So I that's why I reasoned to Anthony that maybe, just maybe, a lot of creativity is going to come from the West, which is, I firmly believe, that the JRPG revival that's going to happen is going to come from the West as opposed to the East.
I think it's going to come from both, and let me tell you why. Okay, I'll tell you why. I think, you know, they're getting Japanese people involved in it, you know, as we talked about. They also, you know, we're seeing Square Enix. Hopefully they'll change their stance. I think it's just going to be a revival on all ends, and it's going to be fucking awesome. You forgot another couple games from the West, too, by the way. I forgot my previous discussion. There's supposed to be an HD rendition of Pure Solar coming out here pretty quickly.
Yes, that is Pure true. Solar. Yeah, in case people don't know what that is, that was actually originally created, I think, either was it on the Genesis or the Dreamcast?
No, Sega CD.
Okay, yeah. Okay. And this is a fan project.
Yeah, it's a fan project. Okay, I'm going to tell people this. For old JRPG fans, there's a certain charm about the animated scenes and the graphics of old PC Engine or TurboGrafx CD games. And Sega CD games, you know, particularly, and I'm talking mostly JRPGs, or even some side-scrollers, games like Lunar, or Vay, or Yiz, or side-scrollers like Valis, or, you know, Lords of Thunder, Shmup. They all had these cool little weird-looking animated scenes. You can look them up on YouTube, they look cool. And Pure Solar was designed to look much like those games. It kind of reminded me of looking like something like Cosmic Fantasy 2 or something like that. Mm-hmm. So that was what they did. They went with that art style, and then there's supposed to be an HD re-release, correct?
Yes.
And it was supposed to come out in March.
Yeah, there's actually a lot of Western JRPGs styles that we completely forgot about. Today, on this recording date, which is actually April 10th, Supergiant Games. You remember Bastion?
Yeah.
Did you like that game?
I liked Bastion.
So Transistor, you probably heard of it, right?
No.
That is their follow-up game that they announced last year that they were actually working on. It's only coming out for PC and PS4.
Okay.
That's a big note. And I kind of...
Because Bastion came out exclusively on the Xbox 360.
Yes, it did. Well, for a short time. It's now on every single platform known to man, except for PlayStation platforms. Like, it's on iOS, etc., etc. But what's interesting about Transistor is that it's an action RPG, a sci-fi action RPG, but get this, it uses an action point-based system. So in other words, your action, you know, it's kind of like Final Fantasy 13, you know, how like have like an ATB system, and then they build, and then if you wait a certain amount of time, you can actually use X number of action points to use specific commands. You remember that, right? The first...
Yeah. Of course, Final Fantasy 13. I like that game. You don't, but...
Well, I don't like it, but I do remember the battle system. So think about that, but in you know... But you're able to do that while kind of running around and stuff like that. So, okay. Like, for example, like, you're running around a room, you have your action points, like, really full, and then you use it, and then you have to wait until it replenishes a certain amount, then you can do your next move.
Okay.
What other game did that? Do you remember?
Fuck. I'm thinking maybe Vagrant Story.
Yes.
Okay.
So this is basically their interpretation of Vagrant Story.
Well, that's cool that you say that, because that company is led by a guy that I've always admired, both in journalism and in game design. That's Greg Cavishan?
Cassavin.
Kasavin, okay. I've always liked that guy, and he's always been a guy that has... He had an integrity that I think is missing in a lot of mainstream gaming journalism,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah.
And he, if you look at, like, a lot of his stuff is still archived on GameSpot.
Mm-hmm.
But he's a huge JRPG guy. He actually did their Final Fantasy X review, you know, their Final Fantasy X review, mm-hmm. a lot of stuff. And it you can tell, even with Bastion, a lot of the influence has been from both JRPGs and Western RPGs. It's kind of a strange merging of them.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I think that's a company to watch for, too. So,
I mean, okay, so that's one... So, really, the two forefronts of this Western JRPG kind of invasion, if you will, is Supergiant Games, which, of course, is responsible for Bastion and Transistor, but also, you know, Ubisoft and all the way up in Canada with Child of Light, which I don't know about you, but if you've been to the Gamer Horizon website as of late, we've been posting a lot of videos of Child of Light.
I pre-ordered it.
Oh, you did?
PSN, $15. I didn't know it was that cheap.
Transistor is going to be $20, FYI. Yeah.
Okay.
But it's pretty damn amazing, right? Like, have you read up on it and watched the trailers ever since? Like,
I have.
Yeah?
I have. Yeah. I have.
Your thoughts?
I think it captures the spirit of a JRPG. The thing about JRPGs, to me, that separate them from a lot of games is they oftentimes have more heart than a lot of games do, mm-hmm. I think. Especially older ones. You know, as cliche or maybe stereotypical the story you say, there's something about the heart. Like, look at Lunar. Let's take an example, Lunar. Okay, mm-hmm. And this is... Okay, Lunar is, at its core, not an original story.
Mm-hmm.
I'll be honest with you. Kid wants to be like great hero, becomes great hero, defeats bad guy, right?
Yeah.
That's the story of Lunar, okay?
Yeah.
But what makes Lunar so engaging, despite the fact that it's a very basic hero story at its core, is that it has a lot of heart and charm with its characters, and a lot of work was put into it to make you care about that character's journey. You know how it's going to end up, mm-hmm. but you want to take that journey.
Yeah.
So I get that feeling, and I'm not saying that Child of Light is any less original than, or any more original than Lunar, mm-hmm. but it has the same heart that what makes the best JRPGs, you mm-hmm. know?
Yeah.
You know, and the best JRPGs can be fucking, you know, simple and heartfelt like that game or Chrono, or fucking complicated as fuck as Xenogears. So there you go.
Well, have you read the, the premise of the game?
Yeah, I think... She's like a princess or something?
No.
What was it?
So, I'll read to you the Wikipedia description. Okay. And this is actually going to make it a lot more interesting than what you think it might be. Okay?
Okay.
Child of Light centers around Aurora, a girl from 1895 Austria who contracts a physical ailment that causes her to fall asleep. Upon waking up, Aurora finds herself in the mythical world of Lemuria, which has had its sun, moon, and stars stolen by the Black Queen. Aurora is tasked with recovering the celestial bodies and ultimately reuniting with her father, who is a duke.
Nice.
Isn't that crazy? That plot.
That is crazy.
Yeah.
Nice.
I mean, that's like a very... And this is something that they've mentioned many times before. They said that they're... Their presentation was inspired by Studio Ghibli and Yoshitaka Amano, and mm-hmm. a lot of, you know, Vagrant Story, Final Fantasy VIII, and Limbo. So you can, and with the art style, you can really see those influences, which is really great. And if you've actually seen the videos that I posted on the Gamer Horizon website, they actually contracted Yoshitaka Amano to make exclusive artwork for the game. And not only that, they hired this musician called Coeur de Pirates, which translates to the pirate heart, the pirate's heart.
Is it Japanese or
no? They're actually French, I think.
Okay.
Not at all. What's interesting with that is that they're based in Quebec, Canada. So, but what's really interesting about that is that, you know, they used a full-on, you know, like the Bratislava Symphony Orchestra, which is crazy if you think about it. This is a downloadable game, by the way. And yep. They actually hired one of the stage production people from Cirque du Soleil, to make sure, like, some of the scenes that are being staged are staged properly and with gravitas. And I was like, wait a minute. This is a $15 game. Yeah, 15 bucks. This is $15. Why do you have Cirque du Soleil, the Bratislava Symphony Orchestra, and fucking Yoshitaka Amano in the promotional materials and the game if this is just going to be a $15 game? This is insane to me. Think about it. It's like, you know, we were talking about, you know, well, we were talking about JRPGs, and I told you I'm not convinced that Square Enix is going to, you know, help out, you know, like, revive the JRPGs because they spend a lot of money. And, of course, here's Child of Light spending a lot of money, and I'm like, okay, I guess I'm proven wrong. Ubisoft is dumping a lot of money into this thing.
Well, let's see how it turns out. I think it's going to be a good one.
Now, the most interesting thing, I think, is that a lot of people who worked on Far Cry 3 is working on this. Which brings me back to Far Cry 3. Fucking play that game, Anthony.
I will. Chill. I will. Jesus. I will play Far Cry 3. You know, I will play Far Cry 3.
You know, I have a friend who played, what is it? Metal Gear Solid 4, like, maybe a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
He's a big Metal Gear Solid fan. I was like, yeah, so how does it feel to be updated? Like, what, like, oh, like, maybe, you know, caught up to 2008? You know? Or whatever. It came out 2008, right? I don't remember. But I'm just, I kind of told it to him, like, in jest. But again, this is fucking fantastic. This is what I was telling you about from the onset when we were having that discussion. The West is trying to take the reins of the JRPG away from the East. And I feel like that we're going to just keep seeing this moving forward. I don't see it stopping at all.
Uh-uh. And I'm waiting for Pierre Solar.
Yeah. It's crazy, though, right? That,
yeah, it's pretty insane.
A genre that has the word Japanese in it is being adopted by the West.
Right.
I mean, let's face it, you can call JRPGs RPGs all you want, but there is a clear distinction between Western and Japanese RPGs.
There is a distinction, so...
Yeah.
But hey, we're still seeing good ones from Japan. I think all the Tales stuff, I think, you know, we're gonna get Persona 5, which I'm pretty pumped about, mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah.
Whenever we see more information about that goddamn game.
Yeah.
Yeah, we only saw that teaser with chains on the desk.
Well, I bet you that it's going to be fantastic. Because, I mean, that's one thing that's really, really interesting about the Persona team is if you look at their progression between Persona 3, 4, and Catherine, they're all distinctly different even though they're using the same technology.
Yeah.
You know? Like, Persona 4 advanced the technology a little bit more. And yeah, it did bleed a little bit towards other... you know, like with the Animu kind of JRPGs and stuff. But what's really cool about that series is that they do have those high, you know, high end graphics for like the, you know, the summons and stuff, like the actual artwork that God, I forgot his name, actually created for not just Persona but the entire Shin Megami Tensei series. So
yeah, hell yeah.
So okay, so we should probably move on to mail, shall we? Anthony? Oh, dear.
had a little issue there. Repeat that again.
Oh, I'm just saying, like, we should probably move to our mail.
Yeah, let's do some mail.
So, okay, so I will read one from Lewis. Of course, Lewis is pretty awesome. So he writes, "Dear crew," which is kind of funny because that's actually technically the after hours people. "What is your favorite video games magazine to read? Mine is Nintendo Power." Nintendo Power's still around, is it?
No, it's not.
Okay,
it's
so not around. How is he reading that? I guess issues?
I don't know. There's no video game magazines to read anymore, except for Game Informer.
Yeah. I will have to say that my favorite video game magazine I've ever read, and if I had the money, I would subscribe to them again, is Edge.
Okay.
They're a great British, you know, like Europe-based magazine that uses fantastic quality in their paper, and their layouts are really fantastic. They're really high-quality paper, and when I did subscribe to them back in the Games and Me days and stuff, like, I loved all their articles. They're all well-written, they're very articulate, they're very critical, they're intensely critical, but, you know, it is one of those things that could pretty much be like a coffee table book, you know, like if had they been thicker and stuff. How about you?
For me, 1993 to 2005, EGM, Electronic Gaming Monthly.
Mm-hmm. See, I used to be a fan of EGM until I actually like read Edge.
Yeah.
Yeah, you should probably, like, if you can find at least one issue of Edge magazine, you should try checking it out, because there's a reason why they still exist. They're a fantastic, fantastic magazine.
Okay, I'll check them out. Electronic Gaming Monthly, though, if you look at those days from 93 to 2005, they were just packed with information.
Oh, absolutely.
Packed.
Absolutely.
Packed. Packed, packed, packed. And I think of all the magazines, too, what was interesting about them was they would have like 20 pages just dedicated to gaming in Japan at the time. Now, mind you, it's a whole different world now.
Yeah.
Because you could look that shit up on the internet, watch YouTube videos and stuff. Back then, EGM was your best source, and the reason EGM was your best source was they were covering Dragon Ball Z games in, like, 1993. I have old EGMs, and that was my first exposure to Dragon Ball Z before I watched the show.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it looked cool, but I didn't know what the fuck everyone was fighting about in that show, because I didn't know shit about it, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
But the characters looked cool, but they covered a lot of Dragon Ball Z games. They covered the original Final Fantasy VI release. They covered, you know, Yi's extensively. I mean, that there was that section, and then the rest of the magazine, don't get me wrong, you know, there were articles on, you know, is full motion video gaming valid, that type of thing. They were pretty outspoken, too, before a lot of magazines had the balls to be outspoken outside of reviews.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I loved EGM.
Right.
And then they kind of became like a Game Informer clone.
Oh, yeah. Oh, well. But out of all the magazines you guys mentioned, including Lewis, Edge is the one that still exists.
Yeah. EGM, I don't think exists.
Well, they do to some capacity, but not to the same degree as they were back then.
Fuck, they were awesome back then.
Yep. So, all right. Well, be sure to email us at sociallinkpodcast@gamehorizon.com if you guys want us to read all of your emails and whatnot. If you have any comments about any of our new segments, just email us again at sociallinkpodcast@gamehorizon.com. We love hearing your opinions and thoughts. If you have anything to add to any of our conversations, like let's say you played, you know, Bravely Default, you know, email us, because we'd love to hear your opinions of it as well. Or if you're playing like a really interesting game and want our opinion of it, or if you're thinking of buying a game, again, email us at sociallinkpodcast@gamerhorizon.com. So until next week, we'll see you guys later.
See ya.